This is episode 97 with David Horkin.
Yeah, big testing is a big thing, but the biggest common problem with not just young people, but adults, is jumping into the solution rather than spending time thinking really about the problem and the size of the impact it can have.
Welcome to the Drive to Succeed podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Drive to Succeed podcast. If it's your first time tuning in today, my name is Daniel, the host of the show. Hey, everyone, I hope you're well. I know some of you are already busy with the holiday season and some of you are on leave, and I hope you enjoy the festive season this year. And I know there is a new variant for the COVID, but, you know, we hope that we come out of this in the next few months and years or so, because we really miss our loved ones, especially those who are working abroad. But for those of you who are here today, I wanted to acknowledge you for showing up and continuously supporting this podcast, because the Drive to Succeed wouldn't exist without your support. So if it's your first time here, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber, please leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. This will help our visibility. And do check out our website, thedrivetosucceed.com, for more freemium guides and resources. All right, so without further ado, let me introduce our guest today. Our guest today is no other than the CEO and founder of the award-winning education company 8 Billion Ideas. 8 Billion Ideas exists to give every student the skills and belief to change the world. Since its formation, 8 Billion Ideas, formerly known as 7 Billion Ideas, has worked with over 100,000 students around the world in 500 schools. 8 Billion Ideas has strategic partnerships in every part of the sector, including multi-academy trust, young offender units, international independent schools, and its work through its partner schools has been recognized by TESS and most recently COBIS by 2020. So if you don't know what it is, TESS is also known as Times Educational Supplement, which is a UK publication aimed at education professionals around the world, created by the Times newspaper, and COBIS is a collaboration of British international schools. And in this episode, we talk about the driving force behind 8 Billion Ideas and the importance of designing the business to scale, not just in profits, but also its impact. Choosing the right role models to follow in the context of entrepreneurship and skills development, challenges David and his team faced during the COVID crisis, and many more. And now, let's welcome David Horkin.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Lovely to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, awesome. Well, David, one of the things that really made me interest in your work is you started early on in 2012, which basically, you know, launched in 2014, if I'm not mistaken. And then you ramp up pretty much in the learning space and creating a product that gives kids entrepreneurial skills and basically helping change the world towards the next generation, right? Because I always believe, like, you know, when you impact the next generation, you impact the generation that comes after it. In your experience, how did 8 Billion Ideas come into fruition? And what are your thoughts in scaling entrepreneurial businesses in this point of time?
Yeah, well, look, so the way that we started, originally we were called 7 Billion Ideas. And that was because when we originally came up with the idea, we felt we were living in a society, and I think it's still relatively true now, that the vast majority of people come up with ideas but don't do anything about them. And the planet's population was passing 7 billion people at the time. So we felt, let's build a business which is about inspiring action and giving people courage to go do something about their ideas. And obviously underpinning that is trying to unlock people's entrepreneurial instincts. And we decided to jump straight into education as a starting point. So we formed the business in 2012, but it really was in 2014, because at the time we were working in our full-time corporate jobs that we managed to kind of jump out and fully commit to the vision behind 7 Billion Ideas. And then what happened over those years is effectively we built a services company in education, teaching entrepreneurship to all ages from 4 to 18 in every learning environment. And what I mean by every learning environment is literally every type of learning environment, from international schools to local schools to grammar schools to prep schools to primary schools to young offenders units, and also teaching entrepreneurial skills in the adult space as well. Now, one of the challenges we had was as you build a services company, you can only scale at a certain pace, because behind every service has to be quality trained people that you retain and develop over time. So that was one of the things which was kind of holding us back. We were getting great attention from around the world. We were picking up our projects and growing at a nice pace. But to really get into that scale mode where your impact is not working with tens of thousands of people, but millions of people on a yearly basis, we were trying to re-architect the business in a way that that could happen. And in a way, when COVID hit, it was incredibly challenging running a services company in a sector where you can't go do it. So for about 6 months, Armageddon kicked in. But it allowed us the time, we're talking about Armageddon, every project, every program we had was cancelled or refunded or whatever it might be. But it actually allowed us the opportunity to re-architect the business and start from a starting point of thinking from scale. And that's where we decided to jump in and really become 8 Billion Ideas, bring forward the rebranding and use the virtual space in a very different way to what other people were doing. So the transition from 7 Bill to 8 Bill has allowed us to learn a lot of lessons, build up a brand, build up credibility in the sector, but also now relaunch ourselves, which we did at the beginning of this year, with products and services which allow us to genuinely work in every part of the globe.
Interesting. And I'm just a little curious as well, why entrepreneurship skills? Because maybe some concepts, you know, within the sector or within this industry are quite challenging to explain to a four-year-old kid. So where do you get even the instructors to teach these things, right?
Yeah, so entrepreneurship as a topic in pretty much every curriculum around the world is kind of touched on. It's not strategic in schools. It's kind of talked about, and schools often do something around it, but are not strategic. And I've always found that quite mind-boggling, because most economies are made up of 12 to 15% of entrepreneurs. There's over 580 odd million, you know, entrepreneurs globally. Schools produce more entrepreneurs than any other profession, but it's not really talked about. So when we jumped into education, we realized that. But there's a whole myth when you talk about entrepreneurship, because people always think it's as simple as come up with an idea and develop it. And it's not. There are a million parts of entrepreneurial learning which you can unpick. And it can also help you even if you don't want to be an entrepreneur, because to me, two of the biggest, the core skills are creativity and problem solving, which you can do and which you can develop through entrepreneurial programs and lessons and workshops or whatever it might be. And they're going to be very transferable if you decide to live a career where you're not an entrepreneur. So there's lots you can learn from it. We've got to demystify it. A lot of people have, forgive me, in the UK, Dragon's Den is a show which is very popular, where entrepreneurs go and get their investment. But a lot of young people think that's what it is. It's about coming up with an idea, standing in front of a group of people and trying to get capital, mm-hmm. where it's not. You know, entrepreneurs are all around us. They're out on the high streets. They're in our shopping centres. They're around us all the time, and they come in different shapes and sizes. So we've got to do a lot of demystifying, but you can break it up into about 1,000 different lessons, which are very transferable, whether or not a child actually wants to be an entrepreneur or not in the future.
When you teach these concepts, obviously, because as a scalability factor, you obviously pre-qualify trainers, or you can say teachers, right? Is there a specific module like, all right, so this should be taught using storytelling, this should be taught with data and facts, or maybe these are the mentors that you can look up to? Because I know sometimes, like you mentioned, entrepreneurship has been mystified, and people look up to the, you know, Sir Richard Branson, you know, the Mark Cuban and all that. So what are your thoughts on that? Is there like a part of your company where, all right, so this is part of the module, this should be rolled out throughout these ages? What does the thought process look like on that part of it?
Well, let me break that down into two, actually, because role models is a big part of what we do, because you're quite right. It's the same role models globally that children think of wherever they might be, or, you know, probably 20 to 30 entrepreneurs which are running the biggest businesses in the world are what children think of. So we do have to change that, because that is there's very few people which kind of get to that unicorn state businesses and global attention. They're helpful, obviously, for putting entrepreneurship on the map for a lot of children, but we also need to promote relatable role models, people that they can see and they can go, actually, I can become that, because it's not just those type of individuals which make it to the top. I often find that the impression they leave behind is kind of a ruthless streak, which, you know, there might be an element of that at some point, but that isn't through the DNA of every entrepreneur. So that's one thing. Secondly, what do you do at different age groups? Well, you tailor it depending on the different needs and needs of a child and where they are. We always find children and adults are on different skills and beliefs. So they've got some of the skills, don't have the belief, or they've got loads of belief and none of the skills. But there is another myth that, you know, things aren't transferable in terms of age groups. So we often find sometimes the things that we design for 10 to 12 year olds could be perfect for 16 to 18 year olds or equally adults. We were doing a training course for 10 to 14 year olds, and we had a parent watch it who was a professor at a university and said it was better quality than the MBA at their university, what we were teaching. So it's all about just sizing up the school, the class, the child, where are they on their journey? And there might be things that we've designed for older students which are relevant for them, or indeed younger students, but any of this stuff is good learning for them. And it's just tailoring it for that individual. There's a lot of crossover between curriculums as well, from what the KHDA are requiring in Dubai to what the British curriculum is doing in the UK to the Australian. Everybody is touching on innovation and entrepreneurship and creativity, but just defining it in different ways. So we're quite lucky that we're not pillared to one curriculum. We're kind of across the piece there and reviewing what every curriculum around the world is doing.
Interesting. And obviously, when you teach entrepreneurship, you wanted also, you know, a part of entrepreneurship is validating their ideas. Is there a part of the curriculum where maybe they go out and try to sell something and make a profit of it and just complete, you know, the cycle of from ideation to market?
Yeah, big testing is a big thing, but the biggest common problem with not just young people but adults is jumping into the solution rather than spending time thinking really about the problem and the size of the impact it can have. So you ask a child to come up with an idea, that won't be a problem. You ask them to come up with a problem that they want to solve, then they'll be kind of scratching their heads a little bit and then potentially multiplying the impact of that problem. So, you know, the very small things that you might be able to improve in your life, you might think it's tiny, but when you start multiplying it by 8 billion people, actually a 10-second improvement for every single person on the planet, brushing their teeth or whatever it might be, could be massive. So we definitely encourage a lot more focus on, okay, don't get carried away with the idea yet. What problem are you solving? How big could it be? And let's concentrate on that. And then, of course, there's that kind of MVP. Take it out, test it, talk to people about it. And we encourage young people to do that all the time. And don't get, you know, you might get the failure or the knockback, but just keep on going. And, you know, my opinion is every child around the world should always be working on an invention.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I'm just really curious as well. What's your background? I know you work in IBM at some point, and then you jump into entrepreneurship. Is 7 Billion Ideas your first venture that you started?
Yeah, it was. So I was a history graduate. I'm dyslexic. When I was at school, I always picked what I enjoyed. I loved history. I loved sport. I loved maths, economics, stuff like that. I went to university and did history, and being dyslexic wasn't the easiest subject, but I always enjoyed it. And it gave me some good skills, which actually were quite helpful going into IBM, because they were looking for humanity graduates at the time, people who were fairly open-minded. I went for IBM Global Sales School, so I was trained as a professional seller working on their multi-million pound accounts. Great exposure at a young age for me to see how the corporate side worked. But to be honest, I was getting a little bit claustrophobic. I was always trying to push things and then realized, you know, maybe in such a big business, it was hard to make the change I wanted to. And at the same time, mm-hmm. ideas were always flowing. It was just waiting for the right one. And when 7 Billion Ideas came along, that was the right one. So the transition for me was about a 2-year process, because I was on the director's path. I was in a good place, but I was, you know, I wanted to go and make 7 Billion Ideas and then 8 Billion Ideas happened. So I was utilizing my holidays. Wow. I moved from 5 days to 4 days at IBM, which was a big move at the time, and just building up momentum behind the idea and investing in it. And then 7 Billion Ideas became the first venture. And I see 8 Billion Ideas as kind of the second venture now.
Interesting. And when you're starting 7 Billion Ideas at a time, is there a point where maybe I can just build something, you know, big and then sell it to IBM since I'm already inside it? Like, what? I'm sure they have like innovation, you know, department as well, right?
That never came across my mind about selling anything back to IBM. But to be honest, IBM always fantastic supporters of, to be honest, myself and Jenny, who's a co-founder, who was from IBM. Ravi, one of our directors, worked in IBM. And in fact, one of our directors now today of 8 Billion Ideas used to be a VP of IBM. So we've got some things. IBM has that kind of culture of great relationships and building. So, and that you kind of make a lot of lifelong friends from it. But there was never the idea to sell it back to it. I'll be honest, exit really wasn't on the mind when we started the business. It was about making an impact. And it's very much the focus today because we love what we do, but we don't want to limit it. We want to make sure we can actually reach millions of children in the years ahead.
Mm-hmm. And in your experience, what is the most challenging part of building 8 billion ideas?
Is it the
VC or funding?
Yeah, to be honest, I've always said the E in chief executive officer is chief emotional officer, because you're constantly dealing with emotion from stakeholders, clients, students, parents, your staff. Like, it happens all around you. I think most CEOs around the world will be able to relate to that, no matter the size of their business. That takes a little bit of time to get used to, because you're still developing as a CEO yourself. You haven't necessarily, you're learning as you grow. I'd say that's a challenge. Secondly, obviously, you're constantly trying to keep that one eye on the next chapter and making decisions now, which are going to really pay off in the future. So it's that constant balancing act of being on rather than in your business. That is a challenge for most founders when they start off. But as soon as you get the right balance, it really helps you long term. But there's lots of positive challenges that you face on a day to day basis.
Interesting. As you know, because you're running an online business, it's not a SaaS product, but it's like a subscription basis as well. So I'm just really curious, when you're ramping up 8 billion ideas, where do you find a good team? Obviously, you have your IBM mafia. You call it. Like, here in Dubai, we have if you're building with the same group, how do you build a team? Is it remote? Is it physical? Or is it hybrid approach now?
Yeah, I mean, it's just to clarify, one of our products is a subscription. We do a lot of broadcasting to schools. But how do you develop a team? It's key, particularly those early stages. And I'm so lucky that I have one of my director of people, Joe, does a huge amount of the hiring now. But of course, you spot talent as you go along. You spot people who you want in your business, and you just find a way which works for them and works for us. So when I look at the makeup of the business today, about 25% of the current employees have probably been recruited, talent spotted, I would say, from people that I've come across over the years. And then I'd say now 75% have been recruited through the new processes that we've put in place. And I think that's a healthy balance, because I think as a CEO, as an entrepreneur, you've got to build that team, particularly that management team around you that you trust, and everybody is in it for the right reasons. And that will often be architected by yourself. But then as the team expands, you need to give your HR lead, your people lead, the room to go recruit and bring people in. And who you don't meet, who you don't come across. So that's the way I would always encourage. I probably left it too late. Someone said to me, like, the sixth or seventh hire should be you make as a startup entrepreneur. It should be a people lead, because as soon as you go past that, then you often make poor recruitment decisions or don't manage the people you've got. So I left it a little bit later than that first time round, and I'd highly encourage that to people, particularly those entrepreneurs running businesses which are beginning to kick off, to do it earlier rather than later. Don't leave the recruitment down to you. It's incredibly time consuming. And also sometimes it's better to have someone in the middle who's gone and done the recruitment between you and them in the future.
All right, awesome. Well, just a few more questions before we end the show. I'm just really curious about one thing. That at this moment of time, there's a lot of people teaching skills related to entrepreneurship, money, finances, marketing. What are your thoughts on that? Because sometimes, like, when you're trying to learn something online, it's really hard to weed out, like, people who are professional or qualified to teach the skill. right? Because there's a saying like, if you don't do it, you know, just teach it instead. It's much more easier. So what are your thoughts on that, especially like in the influencer economy, teaching, you know, courses?
Well, look, this is vital stuff that needs to be taught, and curriculums around the world need to speed up, and governments need to say that you need to speed up quickly to make sure it's not somewhere down the pecking order of what's being taught in schools. It's up there at the top. I mean, we did a global survey to 1,000 parents, and starting a business, financial management, and how to get a mortgage was some of the top three or four things that they wanted to learn. So it needs to be there. But anybody teaching any child needs to make sure that they are qualified and in a well positioned to do it. So not everybody should just be telling a child how to spend their money, because children listen, right? So I think it's really important that if parents are giving exposure to children online to learn about this, that they're doing their homework behind who is the individual, who is the organization. So for us, safeguarding child protection is absolutely key and critical. That's why we have a compliance lead here, but then also the facilitators, which are teaching it, are teaching content which has been written not by just an individual, but by a whole team and been validated by them. And we hold ourselves accountable to our learning standards as well. So it needs to, breaking that down into two, governments really need to make this higher up on the agenda. It's something that I've been talking about. And secondly, you know, we do need to be teaching young people this. If schools aren't doing it, parents look for alternatives. But the alternatives you put in front of a young person, make sure you've done your research. And I wouldn't be an entrepreneur if I didn't plug it, but 8 billion ideas is perfect to help a child on their journey. So it doesn't matter where a child is in the world, they can become an 8 billion ideas student, and we can do that for you.
All right, awesome. Well, I'm sure you already mentioned it, but where can people find you, and, you know, if parents would like to learn more and maybe enroll their kids in your platform?
Thank you. Yeah, just visit 8billionideas.com. If you go to Launchpad, you can see that's our service, particularly for 10 to 14-year-olds. But if you've got a child out of that, just leave there's other things which come up all the time. But equally, just get in contact on LinkedIn as well. That's why I enjoy doing the podcast interviews. You always get people from around the world. I'm being dyslexic. I normally come back to people with a voice note very quickly, but very rarely I don't come back to people if you send us a message. So visit 8billionideas.com or just check us out on LinkedIn at David J. Harkin.
All right, awesome. Well, this was a very fun conversation. And just before my last and final question, I just wanted to acknowledge you, David, for showing up today and sharing your message. And I'm sure a lot of parents would be, you know, looking on towards a different alternative in terms of like learning new skills, especially entrepreneurial skills, like what you're teaching. Well, David, my last and final question to you is, if everything is stripped away from you and you got to start all over again, what would be your main drive to succeed?
If everything was taken away, I had to start from again. My main drive to succeed, to be honest, is leaving a positive legacy on my family, my children now. I want them to see myself and my wife that we have found something we're passionate about. We want to work hard. And we want to push forward. To me, that would be, I want them to grow up. I've got a 5 and a 2-year-old boy, two boys. I want them to grow up, and hopefully the energy that we have for our day-to-day passions kind of rubs off on them, and they find something for them as well. So we want to be great role models to our children. I guess that's really what we want to do it for, to be honest.
All right, awesome. Well, I think that's it for today. David Harkin, thank you so much for your time. Until next time.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
If you're someone who wanted to start a podcast but don't know where to start, what type of equipment do I need to have to record and publish and promote my podcast? What type of format or guest do I need to have on my show? And you don't know where or how to do it, just please go to the website and download the guide, and it's absolutely free. Again, the link is thedrivetosucceed.com/guide. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts. This way it can improve our searchability, reach out, and impact more people too. Once again, thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.